Go ahead and get started. Well, good morning, everyone. Well, that wasn't very enthusiastic. How many of you were at the party last night? Yep, that explains it. Okay. Well, I'll try not to talk too loud so that your hangovers can salve a little bit. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team at Microsoft. Among other things, I'm responsible for the product documentation around high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery, virtualization, store, storage, ESE, and a few other areas as well. And I'm super excited to be kicking off the first Exchange Server 2013 session that we have here in Australia. This can be one of several that we have throughout the week, featuring not just the new Exchange, but also Link, Office 365, SharePoint, and Office 2013 as well. In this session, we're going to be talking about the architecture in Exchange 2013. How many of you have had a chance to download it and try it out yet? All right, just a couple of you. Well, if you haven't had a chance to, maybe see me later at one of the Meet the Speaker sessions. I'm going to be there Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. at the Speaker Lounge. And come see me, and I'll hook you up with a copy of the preview bits. I don't know that I have enough for everybody, but I should be able to do something for you, hopefully. Now, about this presentation, I'm talking about pre-release software. We're not quite done with it yet. Okay, there's still work being done. There's still performance work, feature work, commandlet work, content work, UI work, all sorts of stuff still being done. So everything I'm about to tell you could completely change. I don't believe any of it's going to, but I have to let you know that because it's pre-release software. Also, I may give you, in fact, I will give you some performance and other related statistics. Again, those are also pre-release as well. I don't believe that they're going to change before RTM, but I have to caveat them when I give it to them that way. All right, now on to the fun stuff. The agenda is actually not too complicated. We're going to talk about the architectural changes, and there are many. It's a very different architecture. And then we're going to talk about the two server roles that we have left, the client access server role and the mailbox server role, and I'll explain what happened to everything else throughout the session. So let's talk about the changes. And to understand not just the changes that were made, but why we did what we did, it's important to understand where we're coming from and where we're trying to go to. So I want to start back with just a little bit of history. I'm sure many of you in this room have been using Exchange for a while. You know that back in the Exchange 2000 and 2003 days, we had what we would consider a very monolithic model for Exchange. There was one set of bits, you installed Exchange on the box, and you got everything. And it was up to the administrator at that point to go ahead and configure things, you know, check the box that made it a front-end server and so forth, and basically decide what roles they were going to use. And, of course, back then, we also relied on third parties for data redundancy or backup technologies for data redundancy. We didn't have any built-in mechanisms to provide you with that. In 2007, we did introduce that. We introduced continuous replication for the first time, and now Exchange actually had both service and data redundancy for the first time. We actually had what we would consider a true, highly available solution for Exchange once we introduced that. And that was also at the time that we introduced this separation of server roles, in part to ease management, in part to give you deployment flexibility, but also in part as a reflection of the state of where hardware was at the time that we developed that architecture. In 2010, we had separate HA solutions for each role. You had the database availability group for the mailbox role, and you had load balancing solutions for the other roles as well. We also introduced new things like role-based access control for more granular management, including split permissions. And that was when we began the journey down what we're calling hybrid deployments, where you have some of your Exchange infrastructure in the cloud and some on-premises. Where are we going next? Well, I'm going to tell you. Let's focus, though, first on the previous architecture, the immediate previous architecture. This architecture, which, by the way, is largely the same in 2007 as it is in 2010, we started building this around 2005. That's when we started our design process for that version of Exchange. And back at that time, when you looked at the state of hardware, we were largely CPU constrained. Remember, it seems like we've had them forever, but back in 2005, we didn't have things like multi-core processors. We didn't have Nehalem chipsets and so forth. We didn't have all the fancy hardware we had today. So the idea to give deployment flexibility and management flexibility and to accommodate the hardware at the time, the server roles were born with the idea of taking discrete pieces of functionality and distributing them across the environment. Now, our original goal was to have these pieces somewhat loosely coupled and not largely dependent on each other. But if you've been working with 2007 or 2010, you actually realize the end result was the opposite of that. They ended up being somewhat tightly coupled. Tightly coupled in terms of functionality, for example. I can't just upgrade a client access server and provide a new front end and at the same time give the new back end experience, because I have to also upgrade the mailbox server as well. We used RPC to communicate between the server roles, and that made them tightly coupled both from a versioning perspective, from a functionality perspective, and from a geo-affinity perspective when you consider RPC going across the WAN. So there was a lot of reasons where we had these loosely connected parts that ended up being tightly connected. Then on top of that, there were other challenges. How many of you have deployed Exchange 2010 in production? All right, almost everybody. So you know that Exchange deployments can be complicated. Okay, that's an understatement. I know that. Each version of Exchange brings with it something new and different you didn't have to deal with before. With 2000, it was Active Directory. 2007, it was certificates. That was the big problem. 2010, load balancing became the big issue. And in fact, load balancing is difficult, and it can require expensive solutions, particularly if you want to achieve any sort of scale. We see that in Office 365, where as we scale the service, we find that we would need more and more load balancers to handle the growing and growing number of connections. So obviously, from a load balancing perspective, if you can get something as least complicated and as less expensive as possible, that's a great solution. And one of the challenges that we had back in the 2007 days, we actually got solved in the 2010 days, and that is the multi-core processors. But customers still would deploy dedicated server roles. How many of you have deployed dedicated server roles in your organizations? Exactly. And that means your hardware is underutilized. If you're going to buy new hardware today, a hex core processor, that Nehalem chipset, if you're doing dedicated server roles, you are leaving hardware resources unutilized or underutilized. It's money on the table. Okay, so that's another challenge that we wanted to address as well. And then finally, there's just too many namespaces that are required. If you have a database availability group and you extend that to two Active Directory sites, you need a minimum of 8 different namespaces to support that topology, 6 of which have to go on your certificates. It's a very expensive and complicated proposition. So how have we solved it? Well, we've made a number of architecture changes with the theme of using what we call building blocks, or what we sometimes refer to internally as bricks. The idea behind building blocks is to provide this scalable framework, this scalable model that will work for all sizes, down from the smallest customer you could imagine to the largest service you can imagine, all the way up to Office 365 and greater and greater. And the result of that is you get an evolution of the server roles. You've already noticed we're only going to be talking about 2 server roles. You also get some network layer improvements, significant network layer improvements. We no longer treat the network just like a black box. We're a much better citizen on the network with 2013. And we get our versioning and interop principles. These were key leading principles for the development of Exchange 2013. The benefits that you get, well, they're numerous. You get your hardware efficiency. We have the ability not just to leverage the brand new hardware that's out today, but hardware you'll be buying next year or the year after that as well, particularly in the areas of storage, which I'll talk about in the HA session later today. You also get deployment simplicity. It's much easier when you think of just having 2 roles to deploy, whether you do them individually or whether you do them multi-role. And we don't yet have guidance on what we're going to recommend yet. You also get cross-version interop, and by that I mean not only can the new server do things for the folks who haven't been migrated yet on the legacy servers, but the plan is that they'll be able to interop up as well to the next version after this one. And then the last thing is failure isolation. You'll see that in many areas throughout the architecture itself, we've put in failure isolation and extended high availability not just to the database availability group, but to all server roles, or I should say both server roles, and to all the protocols that are hosted by those server roles as well. So the building block architecture, what does it look like? Well, you have two building blocks. One is called the client access server. The other is called a mailbox server. A group of client access servers are called the client access array. It's not the same thing as the CAS array we had in 2010. I'll explain the difference as we get through this presentation. Obviously, a group of mailbox servers, that's still called a DAG, a database availability group. Those are the two constructs that we'll deal with. And these two constructs are very loosely coupled in terms of functionality. The functionality is always going to be driven by the version that the user's mailbox is on, because everything happens on the mailbox. It's also loosely coupled in terms of user partitioning. I can upgrade the client access servers independently of the mailbox servers and still maintain version functionality. And it's got geo-affinity, as you see. I no longer need all those namespaces. I can actually deploy a single worldwide namespace and use that environment in my environment if I choose to. And it makes things much easier, much simpler, and ends up giving you a much lower recovery time objective in many scenarios. Now, we have one tenet when it comes to Exchange 2013, and that is every server is an island. So if you imagine the one on the left there, as you're looking at it, is the RTM version of Exchange 2013. The one on the right there could be perhaps the next version up from that. We have functionality that we separate into three discrete components, the access components, the data logic components, and the storage components. Now, in Exchange 2010, we allowed cross-communication between servers across those component layers. We allowed, for example, the web services stack on one server to directly interface with the store on another server. That's one of the things that made them tightly coupled. Now what we've done in 2013, every server is an island, which means if EWS on one server needs to talk to storage on another server, EWS must send that request over to the EWS stack on the server with the storage and talk to the server that way. All communication, all data access, all data rendering, all protocol access, all transport storage, everything happens on the mailbox server. This type of cross-communication is banned. And as a result of banning that and only allowing the individual pieces to talk across the islands and then communication within an island only, that gives you failure isolation, that gives you version isolation, that gives you functionality isolation, and it preserves both the down-level and the up-level experience. Now, from a functional perspective, here's what things look like. In 2010, you had a load balancer up at the top that was providing you with your session affinity. Below that, you had CAS, Hub Transport, UM, and they had both the authentication and the APIs and the protocol logic. They also had the business layer logic in them, and then you had the mailbox server, which was basically the assistance, the store, and the content indexing. What we did was we took that middle tier of CAS, Hub, and Mailbox, and we split out a lot of the functionality. We also eliminated the need for load balancers that provide session affinity. We now only need load balancers that provide TCP affinity. So in other words, we don't need layer 7 load balancers anymore. A layer 4 load balancer will work just great. It's easier, less expensive, less complicated, so forth. So the authentication and proxy and redirection capabilities we took from the client access server and moved it into the client access server in 2013. The rest of it, we moved down into the mailbox server. So the protocols, all the assistance, all the business logic, all of the developer APIs, and of course, the store, the storage, and content index. So that's how we separated all the functionality. So all the functionality that you've known from Exchange 2010, for example, is still there. It's just split differently across the two surviving roles that we have. All right. Let's talk about one of those roles, the client access server role. That's an internal domain join machine. It's not going to be in a perimeter forest. It's not going to be in a perimeter network. It's an internal forest domain join machine. And it's a lightweight protocol proxy, basically. It's got three main components. It's got the client access components, so HTTP, POP and IMAP. It's got an SMTP proxy, but a layer 7 SMTP proxy that I'll explain in a minute. And it has a UM call router so that we can do redirection for UM. Can't proxy UM communication because the RTP protocol needs a little bit more direct communication. So that can't be proxied. That's a redirect. Everything else is going to be a proxy, or in the case of a legacy environment, it could also be a redirect. But by and large, it's going to be used mostly as an exchange-aware proxy server. It understands the individual requests coming from Outlook Web App or coming from Exchange Web Services, and it knows specifically how to route those requests to the proper mailbox and mailbox server. And once that request is routed there, everything associated with that request happens on that mailbox server. It's all rendered and provided by the mailbox server. The CAS is just there to be a lightweight protocol proxy. It's also there to provide the routing for SMTP to find the best place to route that message or to proxy that message to it as well. Now, as I mentioned, a group of CAS is simply the client access server array. But it's not an RPC client access server array. That construct doesn't exist in 2013, in part because we don't need it anymore, and I'll explain why in a moment. So the CAS array is really now nothing more than just a group of CAS that are all in the same array, in the same AD site, if you will, that are there so that they can have their connections load balanced across each other to provide service for their requesting clients. It's very similar to what we had in Exchange 2010 in terms of it being the endpoint for the namespace, in terms of it being the endpoint for authentication and so forth, but that's it. That's as far as the similarities go. Doesn't do any data rendering, doesn't have any OWA code on it. It's just a lightweight protocol proxy. The architecture looks somewhat like this. Again, you've got a load balancer up in front, but that's just to load balance the client request. It's much less complicated, much less expensive layer 4 load balancer. Client access has the IIS on there for the HTTP proxy components. It's also got POP and IMAP stubs built in, SMTP and UM components as well. Then the mailbox, which we'll dive into in a little bit, but you can see the basic architecture with IIS. Remote PowerShell is also on the mailbox, which means that's where all your configuration objects are as well. It's also where we have the mail.q file because that's where transport lives now. And it's also where the primary UM stack is, where the primary SMTP stack is, where OWA and all the rest of the protocols are, and, of course, where the mailbox database is as well. So the Internet clients, Outlook Web App, Outlook, Exchange ActiveSync, the Exchange Administration Center, which is our new UI, and Remote PowerShell, they'll all come in, hit the load balancer via HTTP, and then their communications will get proxied via HTTP to the mailbox server where the Remote PowerShell and the protocol services are. POP and IMAP client, same thing. They'll come in through CAS, get proxied to the mailbox server. SMTP, same thing. They'll come in through CAS, get proxied to the mailbox server. And UM is slightly different. UM is sending a SIP request. Then there's a UM call router component on CAS that answers that request and then sends a SIP redirection over to the caller, and they do SIP and RTP then directly to the UM components on the mailbox server. Otherwise, clients don't connect to the mailbox server anymore. All right. Now, I talked about why there's no CAS, RPC CAS array anymore. That's because we don't allow RPC over TCP anymore. All Outlook communication is going to be RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere. Okay, so whether you're using Outlook 2007, 2010, or 2013, you will always be using RPC over HTTP. And that unifies, to a large extent, the client access protocol methods. And it gives us a very stable and reliable communication protocol between the clients and the server and between CAS and the mailbox server as well. And it eliminates that need for the namespace, so that's two fewer namespaces already that you don't need in your stretched DAG environment. And, more importantly, for those of you who do single database switchover or failovers between sites, or if you move mailboxes, that message that goes to the end user that says the administrator's made a change that requires you to restart Outlook, that goes away as well. again, because we don't use those RPC endpoints anymore, so we don't need to persist that information or have it changed when you do those types of activities. So it makes things much, much more seamless from the end user, particularly when you're doing things like moving their databases around in a DAG, or if you're doing things like just moving their mailbox between mailbox databases. So that's a big win for users and admins. And we've also made the namespaces simpler. It's not just by eliminating the two RPC CAS namespaces. We've also decoupled the namespace from the rest of the recovery. So, for instance, in 2010, if you lose your DAG in an extended data center, you can't just recover the DAG in isolation. You have to move the namespace over there as well. It's called a data center switchover. In Exchange 2013, both the namespace has been simplified and recovery has been separated as well. Recovery of CAS and mailbox are now completely separate and independent, and they don't rely on each other. And as a result, you end up being able to do them independently, and you end up being able to get failover in places where you never had it before. Now, what does that mean? It allows you to set up a single worldwide namespace, and that's also one that can be used for 2010 for those of you who are migrating. So what does that look like? So we're basically leveraging the HTTP client's ability to use round-robin DNS natively. All modern HTTP clients have the ability to receive multiple IP addresses from a DNS server in response to a query for an FQDN. And when they get multiple IP addresses back, they will round-robin between them, and they will automatically fail over between them. If a modern HTTP client has a problem, has a hard failure connecting to one of the IP addresses that it has, it'll wait 20 seconds and automatically fail over to one of the other IP addresses that it got back as part of that single query. So you're talking failover at the namespace level from the client's perspective in 20 seconds or less, not failover that needs to be driven from an administrator perspective by modifying DNS and dealing with DNS latency. So we have Sue. Sue's somewhere in North America. She's a salesperson, and she travels a lot, but right now she's in her home territory in North America. And Sue works for Contoso, who's got two data centers in North America, DC1 and DC2. And they have deployed a single worldwide namespace using mail.contoso.com. So Sue fires up her Outlook client, does DNS resolution, and she gets back the IP addresses for both VIPs, both virtual IPs pointing to that namespace. And what she'll do is she will simply round robin between those two IP addresses. In fact, she may be bouncing not just between CAS servers within one of those arrays, there's a CAS array underneath each VIP, but she may also be bouncing around between the VIPs as well. But that's okay, because she won't have to log on again. She won't have to enter credentials. She won't get any pop-ups or messages. Things will just work. Why? Because as she's bouncing around the front end, nothing's changing on the back end. And remember, that's where the session is now. We don't have any session state on the front end. It's all on the back end. So you can bounce around the front end all you want, and the session never needs to be torn down and reestablished. You never need to reauthenticate as a result of this. So that means VIPs could come and go, servers can come and go, things could go up and down, the administrator can focus on repairing things instead of repairing service. And the end user never sees any difference because everything is just moving around in the background from their perspective. So she might start out talking to VIP1 for her mailbox data, and VIP1 will find where the mailbox is, but then she might end up talking to VIP2 later on. Maybe VIP1 goes away, or she shuts her client and reopens it and switches to the next address. Either way, she's getting in without any name changes, even though the paths are slightly different here. Something happens to one of those VIPs, she'll just automatically fail over without any administrator or user intervention. Now let's extend that. Now Contoso's got a couple other data centers that they have in the APAC region. Now, there are GeoDNS solutions out there that can return IP addresses to clients based on the IP address of the requesting client. So, for instance, if Sue is in North America and she queries mail.contoso.com, because it's a GeoDNS solution, it'll recognize that her IP is in North America, and it'll return the IP addresses for her that are for the VIP in North America. But Sue could be traveling, And when she goes to APAC, she's going to have a different client IP address, and she's going to query again, and this time it's going to recognize that you're in the APAC region, so I'm going to give you the IP addresses for that region. And again, she'll just round robin and load balance between those as well. So here she might be talking to VIP4, which again, her mailbox hasn't moved, so VIP4 is simply proxying that via HTTP in this case over to the mailbox server. So it's not heavy RPC traffic going over your WAN. It's lightweight HTTP traffic going over a WAN connection, which is what HTTP was designed to do and which is what RPC was not designed to do. So it's a much better, more stable, reliable protocol model this way. And then again, if that VIP that she's talking to goes away, she could end up talking to a different VIP, which knows where her mailbox is and will proxy the request accordingly. So it's a very nice solution from Sue's perspective and, of course, from the admins as well. Simplifies the network layer. Again, you go from needing the heavier layer 7 session affinity load balancers to needing the lower end TCP affinity type of load balancing. It also removes the need for the RPC client access array and the two namespaces that would be on the certificates as well. And it provides deployment flexibility as well, because now you have the ability to do what many customers have asked us to do in Exchange 2010, which is deploy a single worldwide namespace and just allow the traffic to flow based on where the users are located. So it's a huge, huge benefit. Now, there's another component on CAS as well. It's called the front-end transport service, and that is basically the SMTP proxy component that lives there as well. So the front-end transport service, that handles all inbound and outbound mail for the organization. So two things about that. When I say outbound mail, you do have the ability to proxy all of your messages through the client access server. You don't necessarily need to do that. There's a transport component that we'll talk about on the mailbox side that has the ability to send directly to the internet. But if you want, you can proxy everything through CAS. The other thing that I would mention is when I talk about for the organization, I'm talking about the Exchange organization itself. So if you have, for instance, a SharePoint server that's sending SMTP inside your Active Directory forest, that is a server that is outside your Exchange organization. So it would still handle messages for those servers as well. It does not queue any mail locally. It's completely stateless. There's no storage whatsoever. It receives and inspects the SMTP stream and then proxies it on to the appropriate destination, as I'll describe in a moment. And it functions as a layer 7 proxy, but that intelligence is inside our stack, inside our software. That doesn't mean you need a layer 7 load balancer on top of it. Okay, it's a layer 7 proxy built into the front-end transport service. So you have a layer 4 load balancer on top of it, not a layer 7. And it listens on the same default ports that you're used to with what we used to call the hub transport server, TCP 25 for server-to-server and 587 for the client. So as you can see, the front-end transport pipeline is very clean and very simple. Okay, it just has a couple components. The SMTP receive component, which has the protocol agents, which are in many cases identical to some of the protocol agents we had in Exchange 2010. And it has a router component, which we internally call a hub selector, although we don't use the term hub or hub transport anymore in Exchange. But this is the routing component that it uses to determine where should I proxy this message to. So the SMTP receive, that may be getting a message from external SMTP. It'll go through the protocol agents. It can do connection filtering, sender filtering, and recipient filtering. We don't inspect the body here, so we're not doing content filtering. We're just looking at a few things to see if we should accept the message. Then if we do accept the message, it runs through the protocol agents for the cleanliness, and then it runs to the hub selector so that it knows where to send that message. Once it figures out where to send the message, it passes it to the SMTP send, which sends it over to the SMTP component on the mailbox server. The reverse of that is very similar as well. So if we have SMTP coming in for mailbox, we don't need the hub selector in that case, so it just goes through the protocol agents, then from the SMTP receive to the send component, and then off to external SMTP, which again is going to be any SMTP server outside the Exchange org. Very, very clean, simple, and crisp type of component here. It's much, much more complicated on the mailbox server, as you'll see. Now, I talked about the hub selector and it knowing how to find the right place to go. How do we do that? Well, to do that, we use what we call delivery groups. And delivery groups are actually not new in Exchange 2013. We had them in previous versions. We just didn't call them that. We call them delivery groups now. And there are several. The easiest one to think of is the Active Directory site. That's the simplest. That is simply using your Active Directory topology to get the message to the destination as close as it can be to that mailbox based on the Active Directory site. That's going to be for mailbox servers that are not members of a DAG and for legacy 2010 and 2007 mailbox servers. The next one is also the mailbox server itself. If we do have a collection of mailbox servers where the recipient is closest to one of them and those mailbox servers are not in a DAG or they're legacy servers, we'll go ahead and choose the one that's closest and proxy the message there. And then finally, if the mailbox is in a DAG, that would be the routing group that we use, and we refer to that simply as the routable DAG. And that would choose one of the DAG members, preferably the DAG member that had one of the recipients of the message. We would proxy it over to there, and the message would get processed, categorized, and bifurcated on that mailbox server at that point. So it's based on the recipient. So if the message only has a single recipient, it's pretty much just choose the mailbox server in the AD delivery site that's closest. Okay, it's always going to be based on proximity of AD site. The next one is if there are multiple mailbox recipients, then take the mailbox server in the closest delivery group. You may have recipients that are in multiple delivery groups, so we always want to prefer the one that's closest to us. And then the last one is if there are no mailbox recipients. So we're talking about, say, for instance, a distribution group or a mail-enabled object. Then we would go ahead and just select a random mailbox server, always preferring the local AD site. Again, local being local to the CAS that's processing that SMTP communication. So the benefits that you get, it gives you this centralized place of ingress and egress for SMTP, just like you had with Hub Transport and just like you had with Edge Transport. It gives you the connection and sender and recipient filtering, so you have all the benefits of that functionality as well. Avoids the unnecessary hops because this is not a store and forward. It's an SMTP layer 7 proxy. It's not adding another hop. It's just a proxy over to the closest place, which not only isn't adding a hop, but it's trying to minimize the number of hops it's introducing as well. And it scales based on the number of connections. Again, using the brick model, you can very easily scale this up simply by adding more servers. All right, let's talk about the mailbox server role now, the other server role. So the mailbox server role is the server role that hosts everything related to the data. It's got all the components that process the data, all the components that render the data, all the components that store the data. There's no storing, rendering, or processing done on CAS. It's all done on mailbox server. And only CAS servers connect to the mailbox server. It says no exceptions up there, but we've already talked about the UM stack and how UM does do a connection directly to the UM components on the mailbox server. But for all other client access, there is no exceptions. Okay, and connectivity to the mailbox is always provided by the mailbox database that hosts the active copy. Okay, so we're always talking to wherever that mailbox is. Whatever server hosts the active copy, that is the server on which all the work for the mailbox is being done. A DAG is still largely a DAG in terms of it's still a collection of mailbox servers. You can still have up to 16 of them. We still use continuous replication. Still use Windows failover clustering. We still have the ability to extend them to multiple sites. But if you come to the high availability session later today, you'll see that a lot has changed around storage, HA, and site resilience. So the DAG is still the DAG, but you can do a lot more things with it now, and it just became a lot easier from a recovery and deployment perspective. So hopefully you'll be at the HA session. So the mailbox-related changes, there are several, too many to actually talk about, so I had to pick just a few of them. The managed store, that's a big one. IOPS reductions, another big one. Large mailbox support, or what I should say is larger mailbox support, because we keep going bigger and bigger. modern public folders, and a new search infrastructure. So let's talk about the managed store. How many of you are familiar with the information store in Exchange? I should see every hand go up. If not, you're in the wrong room. Okay, the managed store. Well, the store.exe that you all know and love up until this point has largely been the same store.exe that was introduced back in Exchange 4.0. Okay, it's that old. And as you might imagine, something that old comes along with a lot of baggage as it's been carried forward from version to version to version. Yes, we've done some cleanup work on it, and yes, we've tried to move stuff out of the store and make it leaner and whatnot, but it was still largely the same legacy non-managed code store that we've had since day one with Exchange. Well, that store is gone. And in its place is a brand new store that we call the managed store. It's all written in managed code, and it's using the worker process model. So we have a server service controller process, which would be the equivalent to store.exe. And then we have a worker process, and there will be one worker process for each mounted database on that system. Hey, remember one of the things I talked about of the benefits of the new architecture is what we call failure isolation. This is one way that we get it at the database level now. Something happens where it causes a store process to crash, it affects only that working process, only that one database. It doesn't take down every other database that's also being serviced by the store. Failure isolation is a great thing here. So the store service process, that's there as largely a controller process. It manages the life cycle of the worker processes. So as databases are mounted and dismounted, the store service either brings up a worker process or shuts down or actually terminates a worker process on a dismount. The worker processes, they're there to service the database. They're there responsible just for that one database, and they're there doing things that the store would do in previous versions. They've got an ESE cache. They're doing reads against the database. They're working to do writes into the log stream and so forth, and it's basically all the same goodness you've come to love from the process that manages databases. We also have the replication service. That's still there. That's still there doing continuous replication. It's still there hosting Active Manager. It's still there issuing the mount requests to the store processes. And it's there also storing where a user's mailbox is located and where the inactive copy is within a DAG and so forth. So Active Manager is still doing all the stuff that you know it was doing in Exchange 2010. It's actually doing a lot more than that, as we'll talk about in the HA session, but it's still doing, from the store perspective, all the same stuff that it was doing in 2010. Doing one extra thing, though, and we have this new functionality that I'll talk about in the HA section called Managed Availability. And Managed Availability is the new form of additional high availability that's built in to other non-DAG areas of the mailbox role and into the client access server role as well. So the replication service is also monitoring the managed availability stack now as well. Now, ESE cache management, because we have this server worker process model now, we can't just give cache to one of the processes. Each of the individual databases now have their own ESE cache, because that's how we serve and isolate each database from one another. So the cache management is done slightly different in Exchange 2013. In 2010, it was that large, heavy, dynamic buffer algorithm that we've been using for years that would basically look at how much memory was on the system and try to allocate as much as it could to store.exe. Well, now if we're carving up store.exe into these individual worker processes, we have to have a mechanism so that they each get a fair share of memory. And so we actually dole it out based on, first, the number of databases that you have on the server, based on the number of the amount of RAM that you have in the server, and based on whether or not those databases are active and passive. It ends up where passive databases get about 20 to 25% of the working set that we will give to the active databases. And, of course, if the active databases become dismounted or if they change or transition from active to passive, their working sets get adjusted accordingly. However, if you add significantly or remove significantly a large number of databases or database copies to and from a server while it's running, we do not automatically or dynamically adjust the cache at that point. It would be up to you if you were onboarding or offboarding a whole bunch of databases. You would have to go ahead and stop and restart the service. We will only do the cache measurement values on startup time. Okay, so if you change significantly the layout of the databases or the number of databases or database copies, you're going to have to cycle the service so that it can recalculate the appropriate cache. Hopefully that's something that will change at a later date, but for right now that's the plan of record and that's where we're at with that. So this all translates, plus some other work we did, into some significant IOPS reductions. So we've done a lot of work inside the store schema, particularly with respect to what we call logical contiguity. So there's three forms of contiguity that we typically talk about with an Exchange database. The logical contiguity refers to the store schema, how we're laying things out in terms of columns and tables. Then there's physical contiguity, which is how we lay the pages themselves out in the database. And then there's temporal contiguity, which refers to how the users look at things from a view perspective. So we've done work from a logical contiguity. We've modified the store schema once again, and we've done so in a number of ways. We're using blobs in some places, large binary objects to store data, messaging properties in particular. We've also reduced our use of long value records. But when we do use long value records, we are using fewer larger I/O to get them. And we've made significant changes on the passive copy side as well. You may be aware that in Exchange 2010, the IOPS required for a passive copy is equal to the IOPS needed for an active copy. And that, to us, was not good. So we actually did a lot of work, which some of it I'll explain in the HA session, but we basically changed how the passive copy operates. We gave it a much higher checkpoint depth. We rewrote ESE logging so that we can preserve the cache on a failover, and we've changed it so that our transition from active to passive is much faster as well. And in doing all that work, we're actually able to get the passive copy IOPS down to about 50% of what the active copy is in Exchange 2013. And then based on the store schema work that we did and some of the other changes that we made, we were able to get, going from 2010 to 2013, anywhere from a 48 to 76% reduction in IOPS, of course, depending on whether you're a CashFlow client or not. And going from Exchange 2003 to 2013, anybody just want to guess what the drop is? Just shout it out if you think you know what it is. 95. It's a little higher. 97. That's the number I'm giving you. If you actually were to calculate the math based on the raw numbers that we have, it's more like 99.5%. Okay, so a significant reduction. I made this joke at the last TechEd. I'll say the same thing. At this rate, the next version of Exchange will give you IOPS. Okay. See, oh, thank you for that. They didn't laugh at the last one. I think they thought I was serious. I had to tell them that's a joke. That really it can't happen. Although it could, looking at that and extrapolating it, but it won't, but it could. All right. So that's a significant reduction in IOPS. I can see the Twitteratis over here already tweeting every word. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. Okay. So all of that means, of course, now we're supporting even larger mailboxes. So when I was here a few years ago talking about 2007, I was talking about 1 and 2 gigabyte mailboxes. When I came back to talk about 2010, I was talking about 10, 20, and 25 gigabyte mailboxes. Well, in 2013, I'm here to talk about bigger ones. When we talk about a large mailbox in 2013, we're talking about a mailbox that's 100 gigabytes or larger. Okay, that's what we're testing with these days, 100 gigabytes or larger. And generally what we're looking at, though, when we talk about large mailboxes is we're still talking about the aggregate size, the primary mailbox plus an archive mailbox if you want to give them one as well. However you want to carve it up, we're talking about the idea of giving the information workers about 1 to 2 years' worth of email in their primary mailbox so that they don't have to go searching for things offline and that they can be more productive because they have access to all this indexed information right there. That's what we're talking about. And you can see even over one day with someone who gets, you know, 10 megabytes or 11 megabytes of email over a day in about 150 individual mail messages, you can see that after 4 years, that mailbox is only going to be at about 11.2 gigabytes. And that assumes they keep everything as well. So you can see we're talking about 1 to 2 years worth of mail, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to be growing to a 100 gigabyte mailbox. But for those customers who do have those kinds of needs, we are now supporting that in Exchange 2013. There's one other thing that we have, though, and that is our friends over at Outlook gave us this new feature in Outlook 2013 called the slider bar. And the slider bar is a separate second way to control how much data Outlook syncs down to your OST file based on time. You can see right now I've got my slider set for 12 months. You can go, you know, everything, or you can go 2 years, or whatever you want. So now you have a secondary mechanism. So when you think about it, a lot of people were using the archive mailbox because that is largely the primary difference. The primary mailbox syncs to your OST. The archive mailbox does not. To control the size of OSTs, people would give out archive mailboxes, and then the primary box mailbox would be much smaller, and then that would help control the size of the OST file. Well, now we have a separate mechanism built right into the Outlook client that can do that for you. So now, if you're thinking, well, I don't want to manage multiple mailboxes, I just want to give them a primary mailbox but not overwhelm their OST, now you have that ability with Exchange 2013 and Outlook 2013. Okay, so that's another added advantage there that helps you support these larger mailboxes without being under the mercy of whatever device they might have to run their OSTs on. We've also gotten rid of scheduled maintenance because in this day and age, when you have 24/7/365 access needed to databases all around the world from a multitude of clients, it no longer makes operational sense to carve out any sort of schedule for regular periodic maintenance. So we've done away with what you know as scheduled maintenance. We still have ESC background database maintenance. That's a little different. But the scheduled maintenance that you used to know of in terms of the stored maintenance and the stored directory synchronization that would get rid of disconnected mailboxes, that no longer exists as a scheduled process. They now run as what we call time-based assistance. And by time-based, when they have time and there are resources available, they will run and they'll do their thing. And unlike previous versions where we wanted you to really have background maintenance completed at least once a week, now there's not so much of a rush to do that anymore because we do all this other internal work inside the database. Now it can be done in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, that kind of thing. There's no rush and no need to babysit it to make sure it does its thing. It's just going to be this background process that will do its thing as there are resources available. And if there aren't resources available, it's okay for it to be delayed a little bit longer. It'll wait and be fine to do its thing. All right, let's talk about modern public folders. How many of you are using public folders today? All right, wow, almost everybody. How many of you are glad that they're in this version? Ooh, not as many hands. How many of you wanted them to go away? Well, okay, well, with this version, remember, the lowest client that we support is Outlook 2007. Outlook 2007 is the first client that doesn't require public folders. So if you're using Outlook 2007 or later today, and you're using Exchange 2007 or Exchange 2010 today, then public folders are optional, and if you want them to go away, that's on you. You have to make them go away, because we don't require them in that environment. We only require them when you have an Outlook 2003 client. But since 2003 isn't supported with Exchange 2013, there are no clients that require them, and now they're completely optional. So if you don't want to deploy them, you don't have to. They are not self-deploying. They will not just show up in your environment. You have to actively create them, because they're different from what we had before. There is no public folder database, which means there's no default public folder database, which means there's no default public folder tree. These things just don't exist when you install Exchange. If you want them, you create a new public folder mailbox. The first mailbox that you create is what we call the hierarchy mailbox. That's where we store the writable copy of the public folder tree. Each subsequent public folder mailbox you create is called a content mailbox. And you create them as needed. You create one, add content to it. Once it reaches whatever size limit you want, create another one and add additional content to that. Each public folder mailbox will have its own unique folder content for a content mailbox. All the content mailboxes will have a copy of the hierarchy so that they'll all know where to direct requests to, but there will be only one writable hierarchy and only one writable instance of the content. So because there's no public folder database, there's no public folder replication. Because public folder is simply now a type of mailbox, it's part of the mailbox database, and you can use continuous replication to replicate that data. The recovery process for public folder mailboxes is slightly different from the recovery process for regular mailboxes. You can still use a recovery database, but some of the commands that you'll use to extract the data out will be different, so pay attention to the DR docs that we've written on that. But otherwise, it's just a mailbox. Now, one thing that's different from the public folders you have today is that we no longer use the multi-master model. Okay, there's only one writable copy of anything at any given time, of each piece of content and of the hierarchy itself. So that means that if you've got content located on a public folder mailbox in APAC, and you've got a user who's in North America, they will be accessing that data on the APAC server. That's the only place that exists. There are no replicas of content, and the replicas of the hierarchy are there on each mailbox, or each public folder mailbox, simply to point the users to where the actual content lives. Okay, and that's what we call modern public folders. From the end user perspective, they're not going to notice any difference at all. It's going to look like public folders look in the tree that they're used to. It's going to behave like public folders. They'll be able to create them like they're used to. They'll be able to add content like they're used to. They'll be able to drag free docs into them like they used to. The experience for them won't change. So it could be a completely seamless transition for them. So the way, as you can see, everybody can use public folders. Beekeepers, judges, astronauts, Queen of England, she can use public folders. So a user connects their public home folder mailbox. We still do have that concept, just so they have one public folder mailbox they can go to get the hierarchy. That public folder mailbox will respond back with where the content is. It's not going to be necessarily that mailbox that they're querying. And then all content operations are intercepted and then redirected over to where that content lives. So if the folder's over there, that's where the operations are redirected to, and that's the server and the folder against which they're happening. Any folder hierarchy changes, Outlook user goes in, they add a folder, they delete a folder, they make any change to the folder, those are intercepted, and they're forwarded over to the one hierarchy mailbox that we have the one writable copy of. We write those changes there, and they're immediately internally replicated to the other ones. Then, after that, any other hierarchy changes that need to be made, all the public folders are sitting there just listening for them so that we can have a snappy end-user experience, and any time changes are made, they're reflected throughout the hierarchy and propagated throughout the system. As I mentioned earlier, once you grow a public folder mailbox to a certain size, whatever size you decide is how big you want to grow them, you simply create another one using the web-based UI or using the shell, and you can grow your public folders that way. Okay, it's a very simple and straightforward process. No more dealing with public folder replication or public folder replication latency. No more dealing with conflicts or collisions as a result of a multi-master model and so forth. It's much simpler, much crisper. And, of course, like I said before, completely optional. You don't have to deploy them if you don't want to. There's other collaboration features that we have. How many of you have heard of site mailboxes, for example? Only a couple hands. Well, I'll mention those here. Site mailbox is a new type of mailbox that we have in Exchange 2013. It combines a mailbox with SharePoint 2013. So a site mailbox is what it sounds like, a SharePoint site connected to a mailbox. And we split off the data. If you store an attachment in there. What we'll do is we'll store the mail message inside of Outlook, and we'll take the attachment and we'll store it on the SharePoint site, and in its place in the message, we leave a link to the SharePoint site. So whether you're accessing it from SharePoint or from within the email message, you get this seamless experience across these two content repositories that work together for group or project or team type collaboration scenarios. And everything is seamlessly integrated, not just with the site mailbox, but also with the search infrastructure through the eDiscovery console that we have that Steve Chu will talk about this week, and through the fast integration that we have with the search experience. Speaking of the new search experience, we do use a new infrastructure that has thrown away the Microsoft Search that we had in previous versions of Exchange, and we're now leveraging Fast. Fast is the search engine that's not just in Exchange 2013, but also across some of the other servers, SharePoint, for example, and Office 2013 as well. We get significantly improved query performance as a result of using Fast, and we get better indexing performance as well because we're not re-indexing items over and over and over because the architecture is different from what we had previously. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Fast, there's two primary components, the content transformation service and the interaction management service. So the content transformation service, the CTS component, that's there to receive the incoming documents, run them through filters, run them through word breakers, parse them out and so forth, and then store them into the core, into the Fast core, which is where the content index storage mechanism is itself. Then on the other side, the interaction management system that, as its name implies, manages interactions with clients that are querying it. So a client will send a query in that'll get parsed, will separate out words that we don't want in it and so forth and reconstruct a new query, send it off to the catalog, and get the information back. So that's a real basic primer on how Fast works. But it's important to understand this architecture because when you see it laid out within the context of Exchange, now you can start to understand the benefits that we get. So consider a mail message that is sent to three people, and all of their mailboxes are in a database availability group, and they're running Exchange 2010. When we send that message, we do indexing after we've bifurcated it. So after we've split it out into three messages for three different recipients. So what that means is as that message comes into the system, it's now getting indexed three separate times. Okay, one message indexing three times. Now imagine, because they're in a DAG, that we've replicated that to four databases. Okay, so now we're taking those three indexing and we're replicating that to four databases. So 3 times 4 is 12. Now we're re-indexing that same thing 12 times. Now just imagine, extend this out to the life cycle of that message. Imagine that this message has been around in the system for about 3 years. And during that 3-year time, we had to reseed each of the databases just one time. And after reseeding and after replicating and all that, and after the 3-year lifespan, we'll end up indexing the same message, even if it hasn't changed, about 72 times. Okay, it doesn't seem like a lot. But again, that's just one message I've described. You probably have millions of messages in your Exchange infrastructure. So think about the hit that indexing was putting on it in Exchange 2010. In 2013, messages come in, and before we bifurcate them, before we split them up, that's when we send them over to the CTS, over to the content transformation system. And it's at that point we start building up our word list. And we create the word list and we store it inside a catalog that can be retrievable and reused. So at this point, we've indexed the message once. Okay, so now after it's gone through indexing, indexing re-injects it into the transport pipeline. Transport then runs its processing on it and sends it over to the mailbox server that has the primary transport component on it. Then after that, it goes in. The search catalog has an event that it recognizes that new data has been inserted into the mailbox database, and it goes and retrieves the word catalog and grabs the indexing information and puts it into the content index itself. Then, once it's in the content index, it'll go ahead and start reading that information and processing it, and at this point, makes it into the content. Now, it's reading content that came from the CTS. It's that word list that we generate. Okay, it's the word list that we generate during indexing. Because at that point, once it hits the mailbox server, we're just rereading the word list and putting it into the index. We're not re-indexing it. So we still have only indexed this message once. Now, let's extend it out. This is a DAG, and we're replicating this message over to another site as well. We send it over. Now, content indexing in terms of continuous replication still works very similar to the way we have it in 2010. Okay, the source is always the active copy, and we're always replicating that information over the MAPI network. Okay, so data is coming in, but in this case, again, we don't have to re-index this message. Why? We already have the word list over there, so we can go ahead and get it and just send it over and put it in the index on the replicated side as well. So again, same message lifecycle, same similar process. Three people, it's gone through transport, it's gone through mailbox, it's been replicated, and yet it's been indexed only one time. So you can start to see the significant savings that we get from the content index and the fast infrastructure. All right, last area I'm going to talk about are the transport-related changes, although there will be more transport information in the HA section because it's there. I'll talk about transport HA. But here I want to talk about the transport changes on the mailbox server itself. We've already talked about the front-end transport service, so you already know where that lightweight SMTP protocol proxy is. Well, the back-end is where all the heavy stuff is. It's where we have the transport service itself. That is the stateful service that has the mail.queue file and all the other components that you're used to. And we have the delivery and the submission services. Okay, and those replace the mail submission and the store driver services that we had in previous versions. We've effectively combined them into one, if you will. So transport still has all the responsibilities it had before. It's still responsible for processing all the messages. It's still responsible for transport policy, for DLP, for rules, for doing all that other stuff that you know of transport. It's still responsible for queuing messages, and it's where the SMTP extensibility stack as well. So developers would develop against the mailbox server transport components. And as you can see, almost all the components that you're used to seeing from, say, for example, Hub Transport and Exchange 2010 are all still there. You've got the protocol agents, the mission queues, routing agents, the delivery queues for each destination, and so forth. Very, very clean and simple type of pipeline. If you look at the two services, you can see, again, SMTP from the transport service will enter the receive stack, go through the internal store driver. You won't see an external store driver service anymore. And then we'll have the delivery agents run, and then it will pass it via MAPI off to the mailbox store. This is the one and only place where we're still talking MAPI to the mailbox store. Everywhere else, it's the native protocol. Similarly, transport submission, that's MAPI from the mailbox store up into the transport stack. The submit agent and the other mailbox assistants will run against that. It'll go up to the hub selector so that the selector knows where to send it to. And once the destination is chosen, it passes it to the SMTP send stack, which passes it off to the transport service itself. And again, it's the transport service that would be responsible for delivering the messages at that time. You do have the option of sending all your messages out through a CAS, but you don't have to. You can let transport on mailbox deliver directly, much as you might have an internet-facing hub server deliver directly as well. If you do decide to forward all messages through a CAS server for outgoing, all outgoing messages will appear as though they come from that CAS server. So just keep that in mind. That is what the headers will look like if you're forwarding through CAS. Again, that's an option. It's there if you want to do that. If you don't want to, you can turn that option off. Now, as I mentioned, we used to have the store driver and the store submission service. Now we're just left with just a couple services, just the single submission service and the delivery service, which hands it off to the transport service. The what you used to know as the mailbox assistants and the store drivers, those have been combined, and they're now internal components that don't exist as separate services anymore. We are using encrypted communications. It's TCP port 465, so that everything is encrypted, just like we had in Exchange 2010. And we're using local RPC. You saw that we were using MAPI. That is still local RPC. MAPI, of course, will always be over RPC, but it's a local RPC, not a remote RPC, so it's okay to use it on the same box. And the individual components themselves, they are not stateless. It's only the transport service that has the state in the mail.queue file. Now, message delivery, it's pretty much the same as what you'd expect from any SMTP delivery mechanism. Transport is responsible for delivering the message. When it delivers successfully, or if it cannot deliver successfully, it is responsible for doing things like retrying delivery, generating a non-delivery message, or rerouting the message as appropriate. We still do have other features like shadow redundancy and delayed acknowledgement and so forth. I'll talk about those in the HA session this afternoon. And then the last thing I want to show you is, again, just to show you how mail flow goes. It's very similar to how we do client access. Everything that happens with a mailbox, whether it's client-related or message-related, we want to have always happen on the database that hosts the active copy. So over here, if you look at this two-member DAG, DB1 is the active copy right now. So messages will come in through the transport stack on the mailbox server. They'll get passed to the mailbox transport stack, and we'll deliver the message that way. If something happens to the database, it fails over to the other or gets switched over to the other DAG member, mail flow will come in, transport will send it to mailbox transport. Mailbox transport will say, I don't have the active copy anymore. It's actually on the other server. So it'll pass that back, and that transport will then talk across to that mailbox server and deliver the message to that mailbox. So it's pretty simple stuff. It gets a little trickier in multi-site environments with multiple recipients when you have a larger DAG, and I've got much lengthier animation on that that I'll show you in the HA session this afternoon. This is all on the one mailbox server, so that blue bounded box is the single mailbox server, so it's going into mailbox transport, then into mailbox delivery, and mailbox delivery sends it back to mailbox transport, and then that redirects it.
Yeah, but doesn't that, on the way out again, doesn't that transport then between the transport and mailbox server too?
No, in that case, we can actually deliver it from transport to mailbox transport. So SMTP stuff, we allow between the two. All right. So with that, you can see that using this building block architecture, things can scale really well. Even before we got it into Office 365, we were running about 120 million plus mailboxes on a very similar architecture in Exchange 2010. And so now we're carrying that forward in Exchange 2013, and now you get the benefit of all that. It's flexible, it's simpler, it's more scalable. It'll allow you to leverage tomorrow's hardware. It'll allow you to more efficiently use the hardware. It'll provide you with failure isolation, with interop, and all sorts of good stuff. All right, and with that, as I mentioned, there's all the other sessions that you want to see. Don't forget your track resource as well. There's lots of great stuff that we have for Exchange and Link. Don't forget to fill out your surveys, too, because you can win a mouse. And it also helps us to understand how we're doing here as well. So even if you're not interested in the mouse, please do fill out your surveys. And visit the Business Productivity Stand, because there's this great flight simulator chair that you can not only play in, but you can actually win, because that's going to go home with somebody. We're giving that away this trip. So if you like flight simulator, go try out the chair, and you might win it. Who knows? And you will need your shirt to play. So if you don't have an Office 365 shirt, go get one. Or an Office shirt, rather. Go get one. And don't forget to visit Channel 9 as well. Okay, and with that, thank you very much for coming. I will have time for questions. We still have about 6 minutes left. So let's start with you, sir. Good question. So the question is, what's happening with the edge transport role? So you may have seen in one of the diagrams where I showed the new CAS and the new DAG that there was an Exchange 2010 edge transport server. So at RTM, there will not be an Exchange 2013 edge transport server. That is a deliverable we expect post-RTM. Don't have any dates or shipping vehicles to give you, but it won't be at RTM. And until then, we will interrupt with Edge from 2007 or Edge 2010. So if you have Edge in your environment, keep it there. You probably won't have to touch anything. If you don't have Edge in your environment, then you can just use the CAS to send and receive all your messages. Yes, sir.
Migration from 2010 to 2013, you mentioned that the CAS server, the independent version, so you can have 2013 CAS.
Yes. 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 So the question is, what about upgrading from 2010 to 2013 and CAS server version independence? On Friday, I'm going to walk you through in the deployment and coexistence scenario. I'll walk you through everything you need to know about the upgrade. So come to that session, and you'll learn all you needed to learn. Yes. That's a great question. So when a user creates a new public folder, how does it select what mailbox database to put it on? So it depends. The folder is going to be, if it's a child folder, it's going to be on the same mailbox as where the parent folder is created. If it's a new parent folder, then it's going to be on whatever content mailbox that they're talking to. So whatever hierarchy sent them there to talk to that mailbox, that's where that new folder is going to appear. Yeah, afterwards, yes. Not quite done here.
Sorry,
yes.
I opened that machine.
Yeah, okay, great. All right, who's next? Maybe I'm done. Yes. Will Exchange 2013 allow users to have the same mailbox in multiple locations? No. No. Yes. Is there a public folder migration tool? So I'm going to talk about public folder migrations and how you do them in Exchange in the